From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Indonesia has two solved past human rights abuses. We cannot forget the past. We have to remember the past. By remembering the past, we are, as a country, can work together to solve the past in order to be a great nation. There are many people, thousands of people, who lost their parents, who lost their father, their mothers, their sons, and I think they need justice.
Suharto is dead. Indonesia's brutal dictator ruled for more than 30 years, killing well over a million people. In Indonesia, East Timor, Aceh, West Papua, he was buried today with full military honors. We'll look at his 30-year reign and the role of the United States in shoring him up. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Senator Barack Obama is riding a wave of momentum after Saturday's landslide victory in South Carolina's Democratic primary. On Sunday, former President John F. Kennedy's daughter Caroline endorsed Obama in a column in The New York Times entitled, "A President Like My Father." And today, Senator Ted Kennedy is scheduled to announce his support for the Illinois senator at a campaign rally at American University in Washington. On Saturday, Obama won 55% of the vote in South Carolina.
Tonight, the cynics who believe that what began in the snows of Iowa was just an illusion were told a different story by the good people of South Carolina. And in nine short days, nearly half the nation will have the chance to join us in saying that we are tired of business as usual in Washington. We are hungry for change, and we are ready to believe again.
Senator Hillary Clinton placed second with 27% of the vote. John Edwards, who was born in South Carolina, placed third with 18%. On Saturday, former President Bill Clinton attempted to downplay Obama's victory.
Jesse Jackson won South Carolina twice in 84 and 88. And he ran a good campaign, and Senator Obama's run a good campaign here. He's run a good campaign everywhere.
Democrats are now focusing on February 5th, Super Tuesday, when voters in 22 states will cast ballots. On the Republican front, the campaign remains focused on Florida, where voters head to the polls tomorrow. Mitt Romney and John McCain appear to be the front runners. In other campaign news, Vice President Dick Cheney's daughter, Liz Cheney, has become a senior foreign policy advisor to Mitt Romney. In economic news, stock prices plummeted again today in trading in Asia. In Shanghai, shares fell over 7%. The main stock indexes in Tokyo and Hong Kong dropped about 4%. As fears mount over a worldwide recession, President Bush is expected to call on Congress to approve a $150 billion stimulus package during his State of the Union address tonight. Bush's final State of the Union comes at a time when his approval rating has dropped to new lows. A recent Washington Post ABC News poll found Bush's overall approval rating to be just 32%. Only 28% of respondents approve of his handling of the economy. In other economic news, the National Association of Realtors has revealed the median price of single-family homes fell last year for the first time since at least 1968. The group's chief economist, Lawrence Yun, said, quote, "It's the first price decline in many, many years and possibly going back to the Great Depression." In Switzerland, the World Economic Forum has wrapped up after 5 days of talks. Joseph Stiglitz, the former chief economist of the World Bank, was one of several economists attending the summit in Davos to issue grave warnings about the state of the economy.
There really are some deep structural problems. The fact that the U.S. had to borrow in 2006 $850 billion from other countries, the richest country in the world, fundamental global imbalances, financial systems that don't know how to manage risk, these are not symptoms of what you might call a fundamentally strong economy.
Former Indonesian dictator General Suharto has died at the age of 86. He ruled the country for from 1966 to 1998 and oversaw the murder of over 1 million people in a series of political purges of dissidents and wars on populations of East Timor, Aceh, West Papua. Despite his human rights record, Suharto remained a close U.S. ally and a recipient of U.S. military aid. On Sunday, the U.S. ambassador to Indonesia, Cameron Hume, said in a statement, quote, "Though there may be some controversy over his legacy, President Suharto was a historic figure who left a lasting imprint on Indonesia and the region of Southeast Asia." Meanwhile, human rights activists in Indonesia said justice still needs to be served for the hundreds of thousands of victims of Suharto's regime. This is Usman Hamid, head of the victim rights organization Kontras.
We'd like to express our condolence to the family of Suharto, who must be loved Suharto. But I think Indonesia has to move on. Indonesia has to solve past human rights abuses. We cannot forget the past. We have to remember the past. By remembering the past, we are, as a country, can work together to solve the past in order to be a great nation. There are many people, thousands of people, who lost their parents, who lost their father, their mothers, their sons, and I think they need justice.
We'll spend the hour on the life and legacy of Suharto after headlines. The Boston Globe is reporting President Bush's plan to forge a long-term agreement with the Iraqi government that could commit the U.S. military to defending Iraq's security for years to come may be unconstitutional. Legal specialists and lawmakers of both parties said this marks the first time such a sweeping mutual defense compact has been enacted without congressional approval. The New York Times has revealed the nation's top two American intelligence officials traveled secretly to Pakistan early this month to press President Pervez Musharraf to allow the Central Intelligence Agency greater latitude to operate in the tribal territories of Pakistan. According to the Times, Musharraf rebuffed the proposals of CIA Director Michael Hayden and Mike McConnell, the Director of National Intelligence. Instead, Pakistan and the United States are discussing a series of other joint efforts, including increasing the number and scope of missions by armed predator surveillance aircraft over the tribal areas. In news from Afghanistan, an Afghan court has sentenced a 23-year-old newspaper journalist to death after he was accused of mocking Islam and the Quran. The journalist, Syed Perwiz Kambakhsh, was detained 3 months ago for distributing articles downloaded from the internet which said the Prophet Muhammad had ignored the rights of women. He was accused of mocking Islam and the Quran, sentenced to death during a secret trial where he had no legal counsel. In other news from Afghanistan, gunmen have abducted an American aid worker named Sid Mizell in Kandahar. She worked as a staffer for the Asian Rural Life Development Foundation. In Lebanon, 8 protesters were killed in Beirut Sunday in some of the worst internal violence since the end of Lebanon's civil war in 1990. The violence erupted during an anti-government demonstration to protest electricity rationing. Cars were set on fire and major streets in Baghdad, in Beirut, were shut down. According to Al Jazeera, security forces shot into the crowd of protesters after gunmen opened fire on the troops. The clashes erupted along the war's former demarcation line between Christian and Muslim areas and near a district where Lebanon's civil war began. In an effort to prevent further violence, Prime Minister Fouad Sinoura declared a day of mourning and ordered schools and universities closed. Meanwhile, in Gaza, Palestinians streamed home through the breaches in Gaza's border with Egypt Sunday as Egyptian authorities choked off supplies to the area and moved to restore control. Egypt has struggled to reseal the border and contain hundreds of thousands of needy Gazans who poured across after Palestinian militants blasted openings in the wall last week, the border to evade an Israeli blockade on Gaza. The Israeli newspaper Haaretz reports Egyptian security forces and members of Hamas have begun stringing barbed wire across some of the breaches in the border. In other news from the occupied territories, George Habash has died at the age of 82. He was the founder of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. To many of his supporters, he was known as the, quote, conscience of the Palestine Revolution. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas declared 3 days of mourning. This is Abbas's aide, Nabil Abu Radina.
Without a doubt, the passing of the historical leader, Dr. George Habash, is a big loss for the Palestinian people. Dr. Habash was one of the leaders of the Palestinian Revolution. He's one of the Palestinian people's biggest heroes, and he was one of the people who began fighting while still young for the freedom and independence of the Palestinian people.
The PFLP gained international notoriety when the group simultaneously hijacked four Western airliners in 1970. The aircraft were blown up in the Middle East after passengers and crews disembarked. In news from Washington, Attorney General Michael Mukasey announced Friday he does not plan to appoint a special counsel to investigate why the CIA allegedly destroyed hundreds of hours of videotapes showing the interrogation of two prisoners. During the same news briefing, Mukasey again refused to say whether he views waterboarding as a form of torture. A group of Iraq War veterans and peace activists protested outside the Canadian embassy in Washington Saturday, calling on the Canadian government to allow hundreds of U.S. war resistors to remain in Canada. Protests were also held in over a dozen U.S. and Canadian cities as part of a day of action dubbed Let Them Stay Day. The protests were organized to urge the Canadian government to make it possible for U.S. war resistors to obtain permanent Canadian resident status. In November, the Supreme Court of Canada refused to hear appeals from Jeremy Hinsman and Brandon Huey, who sought refugee status on the grounds of their opposition to the war in Iraq. Max Diorio of the group Courage to Resist said, quote, "We believe these war resistors should be allowed a safe haven from persecution on the basis of resisting an illegal and immoral war and occupation." And in Kenya, police have made over 250 arrests after a weekend of violence in the Rift Valley that left dozens dead and injured hundreds more. Eight people were burned to death, locked inside one house. More than 800 people have now died since the disputed December presidential election. On Sunday, former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan met opposition leader Raila Odinga to try to resolve the month-long crisis. Annan said the conflict in Kenya is much broader and deeper than an electoral problem. He called for an investigation into the widespread abuses that have been committed over the past month.
We saw gross and systematic abuse of human rights of fellow citizens. And it is essential that the facts be established and those responsible held to account.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Suharto is dead. Indonesia's brutal dictator rose to power in 1965, killing up to a million Indonesians. But despite presiding over some of the region's worst human rights abuses, Suharto was never brought to justice and was able to live in peaceful retirement. He died in a hospital on Sunday after suffering multiple organ failure. He was 86 years old. On Monday, he was buried in the city of Solo in central Java in a state funeral with full military honors. Human Rights Watch said Suharto had gotten away with murder, another dictator who's lived out his life in luxury and escaped justice. In addition to the million Indonesians killed during Suharto's rise to power, hundreds of thousands of more people died during Indonesia's 1975 invasion and quarter of a century occupation of East Timor. Tens of thousands also died in the separatist regions of West Papua and Aceh. Suharto was finally swept from power in a 1998 pro-democracy uprising. In addition to rampant human rights abuses, Suharto's regime was also characterized by rampant corruption and nepotism. Indonesia was regularly ranked as one of the world's most corrupt countries, as Suharto's family and inner circle amassed enormous wealth. Transparency International, the anti-corruption group, has estimated Suharto amassed a personal fortune of between $15 and $35 billion. Following his death on Sunday, the U.S. ambassador to Indonesia, Cameron Hume, hailed Suharto in a statement. He said, quote, "President Suharto led Indonesia for over 30 years, a period during which Indonesia achieved remarkable economic and social development. Though there may be some controversy over his legacy, President Suharto was a historic figure who left a lasting imprint on Indonesia and the region of Southeast Asia." Again, the words of the U.S. ambassador to Indonesia. Today, we look at Suharto's brutal 30-year reign and the role of the United States in shoring him up. We're joined by three people. Brad Simpson is the director of the Indonesia and East Timor Documentation Project at the National Security Archive at George Washington University. He's assistant professor of U.S. History and Foreign Relations at the University of Maryland in Baltimore County. His forthcoming book is called Economists with Guns, Authoritarian Development in U.S.-Indonesian Relations, 1960-68. Brad joins us from Baltimore, Maryland. On the telephone from Indonesia, we're joined by Alan Nairn, an award-winning investigative journalist who's reported from Indonesia for years. He runs the web blog News and Comment. And we're also joined on the telephone from Jakarta by Galuandita, longtime human rights activist in Indonesia. She's the Jakarta director of International Center for Transitional Justice and was the deputy director of East Timor Truth and Reconciliation Commission. We welcome you all to Democracy Now! And we're going to go first to Galuandita in Jakarta. Your reaction and the reaction on the ground of the death of Suharto.
Well, Amy, there is an outpouring of grief that you can see on the film footage, on the TV of people sort of feeling sad and coming out. But a lot of this is also orchestrated by those who have the most to gain from a sort of this continuing impunity for Suharto. So it is very strange, actually, to watch the news now in sitting here in Jakarta.
Alan Nairn, you were in Indonesia when the announcement came of Suharto's death. What were you hearing? What were people saying where you were?
Well, among people in the poor kampongs where I was, I guess the reaction was summed up by one woman who works in the market. She sells vegetables and cakes in one of the traditional markets. And she said, oh, Suharto, he died of overeating. He ate too much money. He ate so much that there wasn't enough left for anybody else to eat. People didn't care, or they said good riddance. That seems to be the reaction among the poor. But among those who made money off of Suharto, there seems to be some sadness. And there also seems to be some sadness from the U.S. ambassador. That quote you read, defending Suharto, that's the same argument that was used to defend Stalin. They said, oh, he killed a lot of people, but he developed the country economically. So if you buy that logic, the U.S. should have been defending Stalin as well. In fact, if you compare Indonesia to, say, Malaysia, a neighboring country which started out at the same economic level, after Suharto and the army got done with Indonesia, wages in Indonesia are about a sixth of what they are in Malaysia. There was growth in the sense in Indonesia, in the sense of multinationals like Exxon coming in and taking the gas, Freeport coming in and taking the gold, Newmont coming in and taking other minerals, creating an export platform for Nike, etc. But in terms of lives of the poor, hunger, life expectancy, health, nutrition, people in Malaysia ended up doing much better because they took away power from the army. They put restrictions on the multinationals, and they had a different form of development. So the idea that Suharto's mass murders were somehow balanced by economic progress he gave to the people is just factually incorrect, and it's not surprising that poor people don't seem bothered by his passing.
Professor Brad Simpson in Baltimore, you've been accumulating numerous documents about the relationship between successive U.S. administrations and the 30-year reign of Suharto. As Suharto is buried with full military honors today, yesterday, the lower third, the title on the CNN story about Suharto said, "Smiling General Dies." Your reaction?
Well, I think the reaction can be summed up by the editorial that was in the Wall Street Journal today and the statements of Prime Minister Kevin Rudd of Australia, former Ambassador Richard Wolcott, and numerous other apologists for Suharto's crimes. And I think that the headline might be, "Let the Apologetics Begin." And already, Suharto's defenders are claiming that the rivers of blood, the mountains of corpses that he left behind in East Timor, in Aceh, in West Papua, all across Indonesia, have to be balanced against the fiction of Indonesia's growth and development during his 32 years in power. But the apologetics began immediately upon Suharto's ascendance to power in 1966, and a succession of U.S. administrations, both Democratic and Republican, continue with those apologetics even as they became aware, as they were from the very first moments, of Suharto's murderous reign, his rampant corruption, his brutal crushing of dissent. And from the Lyndon Johnson administration in 1966, straight on through the Nixon, the Ford, the Carter, the Reagan, the Bush, and the Clinton administration, the apologetics never stopped. And over the course of 32 years, in surveying tens of thousands of documents that we have declassified concerning U.S. relations with Suharto, I have yet to come across a single moment in this three-decades-long relationship when any high-ranking U.S. official ever prioritized democracy or human rights over political stability, the rights of multinational corporations, and the friendly relations that the United States had with Suharto as somehow counterbalancing his atrocious, criminal, and brutal legacy.
Galu Wandita in Indonesia, in Jakarta, what do you think is most important for Americans to understand about Suharto?
I think at this moment, because of this 1998 to now, I think the reformation agenda has gone backwards, and a lot of the information about the truth, what happened during his regime, is yet actually to become known or to be acknowledged by the public in Indonesia, the general public in Indonesia, and also by the Indonesian government, obviously. So I think what I would like to say to the American public is that, you know, it might be very baffling to see what's happening now with this all this apologizing and adoration for Suharto, but really the jury is still not out. The truth hasn't come out yet, and we mustn't forget the cost, I think, that both Alan and Brad have spoken about, the cost of the 30 years of corruption and crimes, really. We're still living in this in the consequences of what happened during Suharto regime. But in Indonesia, that connection is still not made yet, and that is part of our struggle now to look at the crimes of the past and actually to find out, to speak to the public about how his actions actually led to all these crimes.
We're speaking to Galu Wandita, the Jakarta director of the International Center for Transitional Justice. Brad Simpson with us from Baltimore, a professor at University of Maryland. And we're joined by Alan Nairn, just out of Jakarta, still in the region, an investigative journalist. When we come back, we're going to play an excerpt of the documentary Massacre, The Story of East Timor. It goes back through the relationship of the United States with Suharto through East Timor. And we'll come back to our guests. Stay with us. Beligayos, we recorded her in her house in East Timor in 2002. She was a victim of the Suharto regime. She lived in exile in Canada for many years before returning to her country, East Timor. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to an excerpt of a documentary I did with Ellen Nairn that came out in this country in 1992, a year after the Santa Cruz massacre, which Indonesian military armed with U.S. M-16s gunned down more than 270 Timorese. I'd gone to East Timor with Ellen Nairn. We produced this documentary when we got back. Again, it's called Massacre, the Story of East Timor.
I lost one sister and two brothers.
It was 10 days before I was to give birth. The army was shooting people, and they would die at our feet, but you couldn't stop to help them.
I know families that were totally wiped out.
Two American newsmen, badly beaten, Mr. Ellen Nairn and Ms. Amy Goodman.
The Indonesian army converged in two places.
Hundreds and hundreds of troops coming straight at the Timorese.
When they came, they opened fire.
Well, we pride ourselves, and I think properly so, in standing up for human rights.
Military assistance programs expose the trainees to democratic ideas and humanitarian standards.
I'm very concerned about what's happened in East Timor. We have ignored it so far in ways that I think are unconscionable.
Massacre, the Story of East Timor. I'm Amy Goodman.
Big countries with powerful military machines should not be permitted to invade, occupy, and brutalize their peaceful neighbors.
With these words, former Secretary of State James Baker explained why the United States was going to war against Iraq. Yet 16 years earlier, another big country, Indonesia, invaded a much smaller one, East Timor, with the support of the United States. What followed was one of the greatest genocides of the 20th century. It is estimated that up to one-third of the Timorese population has been killed through a policy of army massacre and enforced starvation. Many of those who are left have been imprisoned and tortured by a military armed and trained by the United States. East Timor, a quiet farming nation on a mountainous island about 300 miles north of Australia, had been a Portuguese colony until 1974, when there was a democratic revolution in Portugal and the new government decided to disband its empire. Neighboring Indonesia, a military dictatorship more than 200 times East Timor's size, began attacking Timor in an effort to prevent the island nation from completing its move toward independence. On December 7, 1975, Indonesia launched a full invasion. Timorese shortwave radio, monitored by reporters in Australia, was heard putting out desperate calls for help.
A lot of people are being killed, I repeat, indiscriminately. The
night before the invasion, Secretary of State Henry Kissinger and President Ford were in the Indonesian capital of Jakarta, toasting General Suharto, the Indonesian ruler.
Our relationship involves a common concern for the right of every nation to pursue its destiny on its own independent and sovereign course. On behalf of Mrs. Ford and myself, I raise my glass and propose a toast.
Juan Carrascalo, the brother of the former governor of East Timor and himself a political leader now in exile, was working for the Indonesians at the time.
I arrived at Jakarta 1 hour before President Ford and Henry Kissinger landed in Jakarta. And on the same night, I was informed by Colonel Sugianto, who was a top officer in the Jakarta administration, that America had given the green light for Indonesia to invade Timor.
The United States, Suharto's main backer, supplied 90% of Indonesia's arms. The story of East Timor is a story few know about, except those who have lived through it. Six foreign journalists who were there as Indonesia attacked were executed by the Indonesian military.
Australian TV correspondent Greg Shackleton sent this report the night before the frontier town where he was visiting was seized by the Indonesian troops.
Why, they ask, are the Indonesians invading us? Why, they ask, are the Australians not helping us? Who, they ask, will pay for the terrible damage to our homes? My main answer was that Australia would not send forces here. That's impossible. However, I said we could ask that Australia raise this fighting at the United Nations. That was possible. At that, the second in charge rose to his feet, exclaimed, "Camarada journalist," shook my hand, the rest shook my hand, and we were applauded because we are Australians. That's all they want, for the United Nations to care about what is happening here. The emotion here last night was so strong that we, all three of us, felt we should be able to reach out into the warm night air and touch them. Greg Shackleton at an unnamed village, which we'll remember forever, in Portuguese Timor.
And it was to be a report Australians would remember. The following day, Indonesian troops moved in and executed Shackleton and his crew. Though the government of Australia ended up siding with Indonesia, the UN Security Council denounced the invasion of East Timor and passed two resolutions, like those later passed against Iraq, calling on Indonesia to withdraw its troops without delay. But United States lobbying prevented any UN action, and as Indonesia began to execute the Timorese en masse, Washington doubled its military aid. I first arrived in East Timor in the summer of 1990, almost 16 years after the Indonesian army first came ashore. They were still occupying East Timor. I was there with journalist Alan Nairn, a correspondent for The New Yorker magazine.
Dili, the capital city, was honeycombed with army bases and torture houses. There were soldiers on the street corners, secret police watching the market stalls and the public parks. Timorese could be hauled away to the torture houses if they were found speaking to foreign tourists or listening to foreign shortwave radio. There, people would be given electroshock, beaten with iron bars. And at night, soldiers wearing hoods would roam through the neighborhoods, terrorizing the Timorese.
Journalist Alan Nairn and I returned to East Timor for a historic event. A special delegation from the United Nations and Portugal was due to visit East Timor. The Timorese hoped the visit would finally lead to UN action and enforcement of the Security Council resolutions calling on Indonesia to withdraw from East Timor.
We were told in place after place that the army had been holding neighborhood and village meetings to warn the Timorese that if they tried to speak to the UN Portuguese delegation, they and their families would be killed. And Bishop Bello, the Bishop of East Timor, told us that the threat was, "We will kill your family to the seventh generation."
But despite the threats and a dramatic increase in disappearances, torture, and deaths, Timorese had prepared to speak out. They had met in secret, making banners and petitions for the delegation. When the army tried to hunt them down, many had gone into hiding and sought refuge inside churches. But under pressure from the United States, the visit of the delegation had been called off. 3 days later, with the world spotlight removed, the army stormed the Motayal, Dili's main Catholic church, and killed a young man named Sebastião Gomes, who had taken refuge there. And then came the morning of November 12th, the two-week commemoration of Sebastião's funeral. A memorial mass and procession were planned to lay flowers on Sebastião's grave. After the mass was held at the Motayal, people, young and old, came out into the street, and in a land where public speech and assembly had been forbidden for over a decade, they started chanting. The Timorese then held up banners drawn on bedsheets. They had been prepared for the delegation that never came. The banners called on Indonesia to leave East Timor and said things like, "Why the Indonesian army shoot our church?" The Timorese were facing a gauntlet of troops that stretched the length of Dili. It was the boldest act of public protest occupied Timor had ever seen.
More and more Timorese joined the procession. They came from huts and schools and offices along the way. And there was this building feeling of exhilaration as well as fear among the Timorese. And when they reached the cemetery, the crowd had swelled to maybe 5,000 people. Some went inside to lay flowers on Sebastiao's grave. Most of the crowd was still outside. And then suddenly someone looked up, and we saw that marching up along the same route that the Timorese had come, came a long column of Indonesian troops, dressed in brown, holding M16s in front of them, marching in a very slow, deliberate fashion, hundreds and hundreds of troops coming straight at the Timorese.
Alan suggested we walk to the front of the crowd between the soldiers and the Timorese, because although we knew that the army had committed many massacres, we hoped that we as foreign journalists could serve as a shield for the Timorese. Standing with headphones on and microphone and camera out in full view, we went and stood in the middle of the road, looking straight at the approaching troops. Behind us, the crowd was hushed as some Timorese tried to turn away, but they were hemmed in by cemetery walls.
The soldiers marched straight up to us. They never broke their stride. We were enveloped by the troops, and when they got a few yards past us, within a dozen yards of the Timorese, they raised their rifles to their shoulders all at once, and they opened fire. The Timorese, in an instant, were down. It was torn apart by the bullets. The street was covered with bodies, covered with blood. And the soldiers just kept on coming. They poured in, one rank after another. They leaped over the bodies of those who were down. They were aiming and shooting people in the back. I could see their limbs being torn, their bodies exploding. There was blood spurting out into the air, the pop of the bullets everywhere. And it was very organized, very systematic. The soldiers did not stop. They just kept on shooting until no one was left standing.
A group of soldiers grabbed my microphone and threw me to the ground, kicking and punching me. At that point, Alan threw himself on top of me, protecting me from further injury. The soldiers then used their rifle butts like baseball bats, beating Alan until they fractured his skull. As we sat on the ground, Alan covered in blood, a group of soldiers lined up and pointed their M16s at our heads. They had stripped us of all of our equipment. We just kept shouting, "We're from America." In the end, they decided not to execute us.
The soldiers beat us, but we actually had received privileged treatment. We were still alive. They kept on firing into the Timorese. We were able to get onto a passing civilian truck, went into hiding, but the Timorese who had been with us there on the cemetery road, most of them were dead.
Inside the cemetery walls, Max Stahl, a filmmaker on assignment with Yorkshire TV, had had his video camera running.
The soldiers began at that point to encircle the entire cemetery. I saw soldiers as they gradually moved towards the middle, picking out people who were wounded or taking refuge between the tombstones. And when they got to them, they beat them and assembled them in the back of the cemetery. People were stripped to their waist. They had their thumbs tied behind their backs. And they were made to look at the ground. And if they looked up, they were immediately beaten, usually with a rifle butt.
Max Stahl was filming near a crypt in the middle of the cemetery. Some of the wounded and those too scared to run were huddled inside praying. As Stahl filmed, he buried his video cassettes in a fresh grave. Then he was arrested by the troops.
Whilst I was being interrogated, I observed these trucks driving by with more people in them. These people were clearly in a kind of paralysis of fear. They were not able to move, some of them, at least in the cemetery, and indeed even in the trucks, when I saw them going by, were barely breathing. When people are that terrified, it's quite often difficult to tell if they're dead or alive.
After 9 hours in custody, Stahl went back to the cemetery under cover of night, dug up his video cassettes, and had them smuggled out of the country. Alan Nairn and I had managed to leave East Timor a few hours after the massacre. From a hospital on Guam, we reported what had happened to dozens of newspapers, radio, and television outlets around the world.
From Washington, this is the Pacifica Report for Tuesday, November 12, 1991. A massacre in East Timor. Among those injured were two journalists, including the news editor of Pacifica Station WBAI in New York.
They beat me and dragged me over and started slamming me with rifle butts and kicks and punches. And then Alan jumped on top of me, and they beat him very badly. But that was the least of what they did. They opened fire on the people. And these were truly...
日本政府はインドネシアに真相究明を申し入れ、国会議員たちは政府に対インドネシア政府に対し、
This is CBC Radio.
The massacre of 100 unarmed Timorese by the Indonesian military.
Imagens do primeiro.
Photographs of a bloody massacre during a fight for freedom.
That an excerpt from Massacre, the Story of East Timor. We produced it a year after the Santa Cruz massacre, in which more than 270 Timorese were killed by Indonesian soldiers carrying US M16s. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. You can link to our website for all of our coverage and the documentaries to see the images and the video of the reign of terror of Suharto. But when we come back, we'll be rejoined by our guests to talk about the documents that have been newly declassified linking the United States to the Suharto regime. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we look at the reign of Suharto on this day that the Indonesian dictator has been buried with full military honors in Indonesia, our guests are Galith Mardita, who is the Jakarta director of the International Center for Transitional Justice, Alan Nairn, investigative journalist, and Brad Simpson, assistant professor at the University of Maryland, director of the Indonesian East Timor Documentation Project at the National Security Archives. Professor Simpson, talk to us about the documents that you have been able to acquire that link the United States and Indonesia.
Well, these are documents that we have acquired that detail the 32-year record of support for the dictator Suharto by successive U.S. administrations. And we might go back even to 1965 and 1966, when Suharto came to power on the heels of one of the great massacres of modern history. And the documents that have been declassified by now CIA and State Department documents reveal that the United States was aware from the very first moment of the scale and scope of the massacres, that it encouraged the Indonesian army to engage in the widest possible activities to try and exterminate the Indonesian Communist Party, and in fact told the Indonesian army that unless it destroyed the Communist Party and ousted Sukarno, the former Indonesian president, in addition to going after those who had allegedly carried out the coup attempt that brought Suharto to power, that U.S. and Western economic assistance would not be forthcoming. Over the succeeding years, the United States made it very clear that unless Indonesia reoriented its foreign policy towards the West, invited back foreign investors, and otherwise made itself amenable to the interests of the U.S. and other Western governments, that it would literally cut off the Suharto regime at the knees and prevent it from coming to power. And we can look year by year, administration by administration, at some crucial moments that illustrate the degree to which the United States prioritized the stability of its relationship with Suharto over democracy, over human rights, and at the expense of the interests of the people of Indonesia and East Timor and elsewhere, as well as the interests of the American public. And I'd like to maybe briefly describe two instances which I think detail this most effectively. The first is in 1977, during the administration of Jimmy Carter, which people recall was allegedly the human rights president. In August of 1977, then Assistant Secretary of State Richard Holbrooke traveled to Indonesia to meet with Suharto in the midst of one of the Indonesian military's brutal counterinsurgency campaigns in East Timor, in which tens of thousands of East Timorese were being slaughtered. The State Department at the time wrote Assistant Secretary of State Holbrooke, who's now a leading advisor to the Clinton campaign, that this would be an unusual opportunity to press the case for human rights and self-determination for East Timor if that had indeed been the U.S. goal. Instead, when Suharto was met by Richard Holbrooke, he was praised by Holbrooke for Indonesia's human rights improvements and was told that he, in fact, welcomed the steps that Indonesia had taken to open East Timor to the West, allowing a delegation of congressmen to enter the territory under strict military guard, where they were greeted by staged celebrations welcoming the Indonesian armed forces.
Brad Simpson, I wanted to go for a minute to Richard Holbrooke. In 1977, mm-hmm. former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations under Clinton, that was 19, was given an honorary degree. This is in 1997 at Brown University. He delivered an address about everything from Indonesia and Timor to Bosnia. Richard Holbrooke, the State Department officer in charge of East Asia when Indonesia invaded East Timor in 1975. Alan Nairn questioned him shortly after his Brown University speech.
You were the Assistant Secretary of State in the Carter administration at the height of the genocide in Timor, the years of 76, 77, 78, 79, when the killing rose to a peak. And you were the Carter administration's point man on Timor policy. You handled the testimony before Congress and so on. And it was under your watch that the U.S. sent in the OV-10 Bronco planes, the low-flying planes, which we used to bomb and strafe the Timorese out of the hills. Testimony from Catholic Church sources, reports from Amnesty International and others indicated that hundreds of thousands of East Timorese were killed during this period. And during this period, not only was the U.S. sending in these weapons, which were used to kill the Timorese, but it was also blocking the UN Security Council from taking enforcement action on the two resolutions which called on Indonesia to withdraw its troops without delay. We know this because Daniel Patrick Moynihan, the former U.S. ambassador to the UN, wrote about it in his memoirs. That was the policy that started under Ford and Kissinger. Okay, and you continued that policy. So I have two questions. The first is, would you be willing to facilitate the full declassification of documents regarding what the Carter administration, your administration, did in East Timor by granting a waiver under the Privacy Act? And secondly, would you favor the convening for the case of East Timor, an international war crimes tribunal, along the lines of what has been done in Bosnia and Rwanda, along the lines of what President Bush called for in the case of Saddam Hussein in Iraq? And would you be willing to abide by its verdict in regard to your own conduct?
You know, first of all, we're not going to have time to deconstruct your question and take it on point by point here. We've got other questions and we need to get to them. But let me say very clearly, first of all, I don't accept every statement you've just made as fact. Far from it. Moynihan, for example, was not the ambassador during the Carter administration. He was the ambassador during the previous administration.
He started it under Ford and you continued that policy.
I don't think we're going to have time to deconstruct this here. I do not accept most of your statements. However, in regard to the last questions, of course I favor declassification. I have nothing to hide about my own role. If I made a mistake or two along the way, I'll confront it when that comes up. No one is error-free here, but just for the purpose of everyone else in the room, this is not an accurate description of the administration's policy or my own role in it. As I said in my opening remarks, Indonesia was an important country and remains an important country. And the solution to the problem, as I said to an earlier question, does not, in my view, involve a complete arms cutoff. You're welcome to disagree. But I am interested in consequences of policy. I'm interested in solving the problem. And not
the consequences in this case were genocide, a third of the Timorese population killed.
If you want to accuse me of genocide, you're welcome to do so. And if, as far as extending the war crimes tribunal to Timor, or for that matter, Cambodia, where it's incomprehensibly not have a mandate, I'm all for it. In fact, I've recently written a letter to the Holocaust Commission at the museum recommending that they take this issue on precisely because it's incomprehensible to me why various people who are equally as murderous as Radovan Karadzic and Ratko Mladic have never been investigated. But I tell you here, for the benefit of everyone else, that the Timor issue is not as simple as described just now. It just isn't. This is not what happened, and I don't think anyone who knows Jimmy Carter or what he stands for would agree that this was a deliberate policy of giving low-flying airplanes or helicopters to the Indonesians so that they could go out and kill people in the hills.
That was former Ambassador Richard Holbrooke answering journalist Alan Aaron's questions at Brown University in 1997. Brad Simpson, professor at the University of Maryland, head of the National Security Archive, talked more about the documents up through to the Clinton administration.
Well, Richard Holbrooke is simply lying through his teeth. The policy of the Carter administration was to accept Indonesia's occupation of East Timor and, in fact, to characterize the resistance of the Timorese as an assault on Indonesian sovereignty. And it was Holbrooke and Zbigniew Brzezinski, both now leading lights in the Democratic Party, who played point in trying to frustrate the efforts of congressional human rights activists to try and condition or stop U.S. military assistance to Indonesia, and in fact accelerated the flow of weapons to Indonesia at the height of the genocide. We can fast forward to the Clinton administration, during which time congressional and grassroots human rights activists actually began to succeed in limiting the flow of weapons and training to the Indonesian armed forces. And the documentary record here again is crystal clear. The Clinton administration, at every turn, tried to block the efforts of congressional and grassroots human rights activists, arguing all along that U.S. military assistance would imbibe the Indonesian armed forces with democratic values, with a respect for human rights. We know, of course, from the experience of yourself and countless others, that these claims were farcical and that U.S. military training and that the extension of more than 250 separate commercial weapon sales to the Indonesian armed forces through the 1990s, in fact, bolstered the strength and bolstered the repressive capacity of the very units, including the feared Kopassus Special Forces units, which were carrying out the worst atrocities, the worst assassinations, disappearances, torture, not just in East Timor, but elsewhere in the Indonesian archipelago.
Professor Simpson, I want to turn to East Timor and Independence Day, May 20th. 2002. Former President Bill Clinton was heading up the Bush administration delegation to the official ceremony that was celebrating East Timor becoming an independent nation. Alan Nairn and I were there covering the birth of this new nation. And it was on May 20th in the morning that President Clinton went to the house that was being christened that day as the new U.S. Embassy in East Timor. After President Clinton gave an address, Alan Nairn questioned Clinton.
President Clinton, you sold weapons to the Indonesian military. You brought General Suharto, the Indonesian dictator, to the Oval Office and offered him F-16s. The next day, a White House official told the New York Times Suharto was our kind of guy. Your administration, under the JSET program, sent Green Berets into Indonesia. They trained the Indonesian Kopassus Special Forces in advanced sniper technique, urban warfare, and similar tactics. In 1999, in April, when the Indonesian military and their militias massacred, You were just talking about freedom in Timor. In April, the Indonesian military and their militias massacred 50 people in the rectory in Likisaa. They hacked them with machetes. 2 days later, Admiral Blair
The commander for the Pacific, your commander, met with General Wiranto, the Indonesian commander. He offered to help him in lobbying the U.S. Congress to get full U.S. military training restored. He made no mention of the Likisa massacre. During that same period, the Indonesian militias rampaged here in downtown Dili. They attacked the house of Manuel Carrascalau. They massacred the refugees there. Yet you continued for months with aid to the Indonesian military.
What
Why?
Is your question, sir?
Why did you continue with aid to the Indonesian military
if
they were killing civilians?
I can't answer the question you ask about Admiral Blair. You'll have to ask him that because I'm not aware of that.
He was working for you. Why did you continue military aid to Indonesia?
But I understand that. I think, first of all, I don't believe America or any of the other countries was sufficiently sensitive in the beginning and for a long time, and a long time before 1999, going all the way back to the 70s, to the suffering of the people of East Timor. I don't think we can defend everything we did. I think that our objective, which was to try to keep Indonesia from coming apart and from having some of the influences that I think we still worry about in Indonesia dominate, led us to do some things which, in my judgment, made us not as sensitive as we should have been to the suffering of the people here. And all I can tell you is that when it became obvious to me what was really going on, and that we couldn't justify not standing up for what the East Timorese wanted and for the decent treatment for them, just under the guise of trying to hold Indonesia together for larger foreign policy reasons, I tried to make sure we had the right policy. And that's what I said today. That's what we tried to do. I can't say that everything we did before 1999 was right. I'm not here to defend everything we did. We never tried to sanction or support the oppression of the East Timorese. But I think if you look at American foreign policy for the 30, 40 years before that, all during the Cold War, there were times when, for all kinds of reasons, we thought we needed to support countries and holding them together and keeping them going in a certain direction, which made us insufficiently sensitive to what was happening to some minority groups. So that's my answer. I think we did the right thing in New Zealand. I think we did the right thing in the UN. I think we did the right thing in bringing the Australians and the ASEAN troops here. And I think the right thing to do is to do what the leaders of East Timor said. They want to look forward, you want to look backward. I'm going to stick with the leaders. You want to look backward, have at it, but you'll have to have help from someone else.
During 1999.
President Clinton being questioned by journalist Alan Nairn in East Timor on May 20th, 2002, the day East Timor became the newest nation in the world. We only have 2 minutes left. Alan Nairn, President Clinton said, you want to look backward, he wants to look forward. Your response?
That's an interesting defense for murder. Imagine, I take out a gun, I shoot a guy, the police arrest me, and then I say to the police, sorry, you can't touch me, that was in the past. You want to look back, I want to look forward. I think the question today is for Hillary. Hillary is saying she has experience. That experience is based on the Clinton administration. Ask her, what was her role in the decisions to send snipers and sniper training to Suharto, to give them training in PSYOPs and air assault and ground assault? If she didn't have a role, ask her, why didn't she speak out publicly and protest what her husband was doing? Clinton talked about keeping Indonesia together, stability. Well, it is stability for a ruler when you rule a country with an iron fist and a grandfatherly smile, as the New York Times put it in 1993. But it's not stability for the people. If somebody can kick down your door in the middle of the night and drag you away, that's not stable. If you don't know if you're going to be able to feed all your kids the next day, that's not stable. If you can go to jail for criticizing the president, that's not stable. Another important point. It's not just Suharto who's dead. It's today's Indonesia. Just this week, General Joko, the handpicked new military commander of the current general running Indonesia, General Susilo, he said Indonesia's not ready for democracy right now in West Papua, in the rural regions especially.
We have 5 seconds.
The military is carrying out Timor-type killing operations, using the Kopassus, using many of the same officers. One of the very generals, Tono Suratman, who carried out those 99 Timor massacres, has just been promoted and put in charge of all of Kalimantan, a big area in Indonesia.
Alan Nairn, we're going to have to leave it there. We want to thank you for being with us, speaking to us from Asia, from the region just out of Indonesia, as well as Galawardita from Jakarta and Brad Simpson, University of Maryland. We'll link to the documents. This has been a special on Suharto. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.